Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is James C. Zimring. He's a professor of pathology at the University of Virginia. He's considered an international expert in the field of transfusion biology. And we're talking about his new book, What Science Really Is and How It Really Works. Jim, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for having me.
What pushed you to write this book?
You know, I have spent a lot of time in graduate education, and when I was at Emory University, I was teaching a course on methods in immunology and science, and the students they taught me what they wanted to know. They really didn't want to know at that time how you do this one type of experiment. They were interested in general epistemological questions, questions about what science is, because students go into science all excited, and then they realize, wait a minute, I'm not sure what it is that we're supposed to be doing.
Does anybody actually teach that course?
Oh, I can't speak for every university, you know, in the country, but in my general experience, no. In my experience,
it seems like something we should be having at like high school level.
I would think so, absolutely.
Now, you have two goals for this book, and it's two different audiences, I guess I would say. One is to the non-scientists, and one is to actually scientists. One is that you have to have reasonable expectations about what science does. And it is amazing when you talk to people what they think science does and what its goal is and how it goes about it.
It is amazing. It's really a problem. And, you know, both audiences probably have the same problem, is that they exaggerate the certainty with which science can prove anything. And that's a problem in multiple ways, not the least of which is it has been used in a disingenuous attempt by those who would oppose evidence to support ridiculous claims. And that's the sad part of it.
Yes, it's sort of like we have a cartoon idea of science, sort of like gotten from TV and the movies. and I think that's the bulk of what we think about science. The thing that was interesting to me is you mentioned an awful lot of people in the sciences don't have a clear idea about what science is about. And sometimes that's very disappointing to, for instance, graduate students that are starting out.
Absolutely true. I think a lot of grad students come into science with the conception they had from high school. It's clean. It's logical. You state a hypothesis. You do an experiment. You get a clear answer, and you move on. And then they get into the lab, and they start doing real science, and things are messy, and they're confusing, and they're not necessarily logical. And they think, oh, no, I have a bad advisor, or I'm being a bad scientist. And that's not true. It's just that the reality of discovery is very different from how we explain it after the fact.
That's one of my big takeaways I got from your book, is that science doesn't work in a lot, and this is, I think, a quote from your book, a logical, orderly process. It's not like this straight line, like we are now going to discover A. As you mentioned towards the end of the book, oftentimes people are on the way to A, and they find out something totally different, and then they follow that.
Absolutely. In fact, I think you could argue historically the greatest breakthroughs have come from unlikely sources, and therefore when we say, well, my goal is to study X, maybe so, but you got to keep your eyes and ears wide open because you're probably going to find why and you don't want to miss it.
That's right. And so there's a sort of a zigzag, almost randomness or a crazy random pattern, a random walk element about the progress of science.
I wouldn't call it random because, you know, nature.
I know you don't like random. I know that.
Well, nature is a coherent thing. We're just incoherent monkeys, right, trying to understand nature. So what happens is we kind of find our way in the dark, and then afterwards we can explain with pretty good logic what happened. But saying what's going to happen next is the challenge.
Well, there's a great quote in your book. Science is an extension of human thinking that also violates aspects of human thinking. Explain that.
Well, look, we evolved to approach the world in a certain way, and we evolved patterns of thinking that help us reproduce at a greater rate. We didn't evolve to learn the truth about things. So we perceive things in ways that are advantageous, and oftentimes what is really happening is so antithetical to human common sense that scientists have to unlearn their instinctual thinkings and adopt a different approach to get to the right answer.
You have numerous examples of this where the way that we think often gets in the way of science. That the normal way that humans perceive things, we often have to work against that in order to do good science.
It's absolutely true, in my opinion. We are very good at finding patterns that are there and we're very good at finding patterns that aren't there, and we're very good at ascribing causes that are just correlations. And the revelation of the scientific revolution, if I can use that word, is that we don't stop with observation. We do interventional experiments to test our more primitive inclinations, as opposed to just resting on our primitive inclinations. But those tests go against our primitive inclinations. We're asking ourselves to doubt what is our instinct to believe. And that's a real stretch.
Well, and there's a dramatic example in your book, and even though this is just a little side road in the book, I need you to talk about it because it screwed me up. The Monty Hall problem is a great example of our common sense instincts tell us one thing, where the reality is something totally different.
And this is a great example because, I mean, even Nobel, you know, prize-winning physicists and mathematicians look at this and say, wait a minute, that can't be right.
I'll tell you, Jim, I was going to write you a letter. I was damned. I was going like, that can't be right. And then you did explain it. But I want you to set up the problem for me. And this is a classic example where even our most intelligent ideas about how things work can mislead us.
So this is based upon a game show example, but the basic example in short is there's three doors, and behind one of the doors are a bunch of prizes, and behind the other three doors is absolutely nothing. And the game show host says, choose a door, and you say, I choose door number one. Now, the game show host, this is important, knows where the prizes are.
Right.
And opens one of the other doors that doesn't have the prizes behind it. So they open door number three, and it's empty.
And
so
I've chosen door number one, let's say.
Yeah, you've chosen door number one. The game show host opens door number three, it's empty. And then the host says to you, now, the prizes are behind one of the doors. You can stick with the first door you chose, or you can switch to the second door either way.
And wait a minute. And then my instinct would tell me, my intelligence or my past experience would tell me, well, wait a minute. Why choose? It's the odds against this being the right door are the same no matter what. I shouldn't change. I should just stick with it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, no matter how many times I explain this to someone else, I still feel like it shouldn't be.
Well, that's what I'm asking, because this is a perfect example of what we're talking about. Your gut reaction is really, it shouldn't make any difference.
Right, but it does, because if you stick with the door you chose, you're going to win much less frequently than if you switch. And the reason is that there's background information you're ignoring, because the game show host knew which door the prize were behind and would only open the empty one. So the second door, the one you didn't choose, survived the selection process, and therefore it's more likely that the prizes are behind that. The first door, it's just a one-third chance because you chose at random. The second door survived this process, so you're ignoring background information.
I'm going to get emails on this, I know.
Well, so this is a famous, you know, again, famous example. You can model it. You can demonstrate it. It's empirically, you can show it. This is the case mathematically. We could spend more time going into.
But the larger point is that it gets to what we were talking about, that how we think the world works, or at least our reactions to how the world works, our ideas about it, can be very, very misleading. So science has to often work against that. I want to talk about induction, deduction, and then retroduction, which I wasn't that familiar with until I read your book.
Right. So these are kind of the toolboxes of human thinking. And, you know, induction is just saying, well, every day this has happened, so I think it's going to happen the next day.
The sun's going to come up tomorrow.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a reasonable prediction. But as a number of people showed, David Hume most famously, mm-hmm. You can't demonstrate that for a certainty. Or it's not even logical because, you know, the day will come. When the sun doesn't come, well, I guess it won't be a day, right? But the time will come when the sun doesn't come up. And we all know that there have been things that we do over and over again, and then the next time something bad goes to happen. That's induction, and we largely make our way through the world with that. Deduction is kind of mathematical thinking where we say, well, you know, if A equals B and B equals C, therefore A equals C. And a lot of us reason through life this way. I would say all humans reason through life this way to problem solve. But the issue is, where did those premises come from?
Right.
How do you know what the initial conditions are to reason forward? And you could say, well, because I observe them. Well, okay, well, that's induction. So now induction is the basis for deduction, and that doesn't help you. So unless you're going to say, I know this through revelation or some absolute innate ability to know a truth, deduction has no footing to develop on. A retroduction is seeing an effect and guessing at the cause that led to that effect. And you know the problem there is that no matter what you guess at, there could always be other things that cause it, and you just can't nail it down. So it's actually not even a form of logic, a lot of people would say. And humans swirl these three things together in their thinking real time. But in the sciences, when someone says, I saw X and I hypothesized it's caused by Y, that is classic retroduction. And the problem scientists have is that it feels as though you can prove things that way, right? It feels as though you can say, well, the planets move this way. Newton hypothesized X, and that explains all the planets. Therefore, his hypothesis is correct. But that is logically unsupportable.
Now, you came up with the term hypothetico-deductivism, or HD as you pronounce it, as a system of thinking. Explain that.
So that's not my term. That's a term kind of taken from a philosopher named Carl Hempel. But basically, the idea is that humans use all three of these methods, induction, deduction, and hypotheses, to try to explain what's going on. And your car doesn't start. And you don't know why your car doesn't start, because every other morning it started. So something must have gone wrong. So you hypothesize that the battery is dead. That's a hypothesis. If the battery were dead, you could deduce forward that the car would not start. But the problem with that hypothesis is you can't prove it, because it could also be the electrical system in the car is gone, or there's no gas, or the engine is gone, your friend stole it, or whatever. And so then you do tests to try to distinguish between the hypotheses. But we use induction as the basis of our beliefs. We use retroduction to hypothesize explanations, and then we use deduction to test those explanations. But again, it happens real time all at once.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is James C. Zimmering, professor of pathology at the University of Virginia. He's considered an international expert in the field of transfusion biology, and he's written a really important book, and a great book to read, What Science Really Is and How It Really Works. So how do we use HD thinking to differentiate, say, between science and non-science and pseudoscience? And a good you use some great examples towards the end of the book, like intelligent design. And I've listened to people who believe in intelligent design argue that, in fact, they're doing science. And why isn't what they do scientific, what they're thinking, what they propose, why isn't that a scientific theory?
It's a super important question from a number of different angles. And let me start by saying that I think I can argue fairly strongly that intelligent design is not a science. That doesn't make it wrong, by the way.
You're very clear about that in the book, and I want to make that clear for the benefit of the audience. You never diss people's spiritual or religious beliefs at all, and you say it's not that they're wrong, it's that this is not science. There's a difference.
It's a very important posture to maintain, because unfortunately often those who are trying to explain science get caught up in some mad polemic against other ways of thinking. Science is an approach to understanding natural phenomenon, and it's not the only approach to understanding or to knowledge, but it is the only approach that is linked to natural phenomenon in a way that is logically testable in the way that we think about it. So intelligent design basically says, I look at the world around me, and it couldn't have just come into being on its own. Look at it. For God's sake, it's obvious. Like the Monty Hall problem is obvious. It's obvious someone must have created it, and that's fine. That's a retroduction. That's a very reasonable retroduction. Where it goes non-scientific is it says, and therefore, the existence of the creator explains what there is. And then, well, okay, how are you going to test that idea? Now, an idea that's not testable is not wrong, but an idea that's not testable is not science. And you say, well, of course it's testable. I can see that if God was around, this would happen, and that would happen, and the other thing would happen. And the problem is there is nothing that can occur that would reject the hypothesis, because God is a cognition. God presumably can do whatever he or she wants whenever he or she wants to do it. So anything that happens, that's God's explanation. Evolution theory, for instance, which is often put up against creation design, if you found a layer in the fossil record where humans and dinosaurs coexisted, evolutionary theory would have a real problem with that. it really couldn't handle it. You sort of have to modify or throw it out or change your construct somehow.
But the idea is that science would do that.
Science would do that. But in intelligent design, there is no conceivable observation at all that could ever compel any change to the belief construct. And if that's the case, it's philosophy, it's religion, it's just not science.
And you also take up astrology, and I want to talk about this because I have so many friends that do this, and it's great. You mentioned Massimo Pilucci's Nonsense on Stilts. I actually interviewed him about that book when it came out several years ago.
Great book.
It is a great book. But I have a knee-jerk thing where I just go crazy about astrology, mainly because it's based on like the Ptolemaic view of the universe. When people start talking about Mercury in retrograde, it's because they thought the Earth was at the center of the universe and the apparent motion of Mercury seemed to go backwards. But it's wrong, and I don't get how people still buy this.
You know, again, this is a retroduction problem. Humans are really good at finding patterns that aren't there and attributing cause to it. And the story I'll tell is that you come out of your house one day and your neighbor is smashing your mailbox with a baseball bat. And you say, Fred, what are you doing? And he says, I'm smashing your mailbox with a baseball bat. And you said, yeah, I can see that, but why? And he says, well, to keep the elephants away. And you say, well, there have never been elephants here. And he says, see, it's working. So, you know, again, you get into the situation where anything supports the theory no matter what you do. And there are real associations, of course. I mean, there are people who are going to have a really bad day when Mercury is going in retrograde. And they notice that. They just fail to notice all the bad days they have when Mercury is not going into retrograde. And so they build belief constructs that no evidence could ever reject, and they live in that construct. And again, that's fine to believe that, but that cannot be scientific. And where it becomes problematic is where they sell their predictions to people. They provide guarantees, and people change their lives.
That's right.
You know, based
on
a prediction. But what they're doing is they're randomly combining one thing with another thing, and so it's really there that I think it's problematic because you know it's not a benign issue.
What's fascinating to me, and you brought this up in your book, is that they're talking about constellations as if they're objects. And they're not. They're just apparent conglomerations of stars seen from Earth that, if you were to see them from some other location, aren't there.
Well, right, because it's three-dimensional.
I mean,
Orion, if you take the stars at their distance, Orion ceases to be Orion. And remember, since astrological theory was developed, and remember, it was a very mainstream theory. In fact, astronomy only developed historically to allow us to make astrological predictions and prognostications. But there are so many stars we're now aware of, whole universes we're aware of, that were not present when astrology formed. Shouldn't we be building those into the astrological
yeah.
forecast? And if all of them have an immediate effect upon me at the time I was born, doesn't that change things? And wait a minute. Do all people with my same birthday in the same location that were born in the hospital with me have identical fates and personalities? And is it all the same? You know, regrettably, it's a very interesting system. Nobody doubts that celestial bodies affect the Earth, right? I mean, the moon causes
right.
the tides to change, and the sun causes our seasons as the Earth, you know, rotates or goes back and forth. But that's a big cry to saying that a star billions of light years away instantly and by no explanation can change, you know, who I marry. It's just, and more importantly, though, to the book, no possible experiment that you could run, no evidence you could gather that could reject it in any meaningful way. So,
and this brings up another interesting case, and you address this in the book, and I've had numerous conversations about this with physicists, about string theory and the multiverse, because in both cases, they seem to be untestable hypothesis. So is string theory and ideas about the multiverse science or not?
I can't answer that question because I don't know what's going to happen. So this is going to seem like a very odd distinction. When Einstein proposed relativity theory, there was no existing experiment that they could run at that time that would test any of its predictions. Sir Arthur Eddington, you know, traveled across the Earth to see a solar eclipse that happened by chance, and that was the first one. Most of the rest came later from technology. So But it seems odd to say that Einstein, Albert Einstein, was just doing philosophy. You know, that wasn't scientific. But there were conceivable experiments that could be run. And so if a string theorist is just playing around with the math, I'm not sure if they're being a scientist. But if they're thinking in ways that could lead to testable predictions or trying to develop technologies that might be applied to the predictions, then they are doing science. So that may seem like a very subtle distinction, but it's all about the ability to gather evidence that could reject the hypothesis. And if there's no way that can ever happen, I think arguably it might not be not a scientific thing.
By the way, that discussion is a flashpoint in theoretical physics right now, because I can't tell you the number of books and people I've interviewed talking about it. Most recently about the multiverse, I had a scientist tell me that the multiverse isn't a theory, it's the outcome of other ideas about the universe. And so if you do the math in a certain way, then the outcome is the multiverse. So he's saying it's not even a theory. It's not a theory. It's an outcome.
Well, unfortunately, we do these things all the time. So when Gregor Mendel was looking at wrinkles and smooth peas, and they said, "Well, what causes that?" He said, "Well, a gene caused that." I said, "Well, what does that mean?" But it doesn't mean anything. It's just a conceptual placeholder. Although over time, a molecular biologist has figured out what genes are and how they work. The heavens don't work without dark matter. So physicists say, well, Newtonian physics doesn't explain anything unless we say that, you know, most of the universe is made of dark matter. And you say, okay, well, what's dark matter? And they say, well, it's this really dense thing that by its own nature you can never observe because light can't escape it. Like, I don't know.
That starts to approach, you know, things like in intelligent design. I mean, when you get to a thing like by its very nature, it can't be detected, therefore tested, then I'm not sure what that is.
But it really does. But there's a very important distinction here, is that early on, they didn't know what genes were, but ultimately we came up with a way of detecting them. When Louis Pasteur said germs are causing this, we found ways to detect the germs because it was theoretically possible to develop the technologies to detect this. Is it possible we can develop a technology that might detect dark matter? Sure. Is it possible that we can develop a technology that can quantify God? This seems less likely. So I think that there's a distinction between supernatural and natural that I get into the book that's hard to explain in simple terms, but
that's right.
Is critical to these lines.
You need to buy the book. Don't forget, always push the book.
Please buy the book.
But I think that for me the difference is scientists are always looking for ways to test these hypotheses. So they're constantly searching and saying that maybe we'll be able to create dark matter at CERN at some point in the Large Hadron Collider. And they're actually looking for creating some kind of parameters where they might be able to make dark matter. So they're looking for it, unlike people who, for instance, intelligent design. They're not searching for that ultimate answer. They're not searching. They're not testing it.
What's really funny about science, one of the things I love, is that it puts human pettiness to its greatest purpose. Because, you know, scientists are no different than any other humans. They fall in love with their own hypotheses, and they look for evidence to support their hypothesis, and they ignore evidence to reject it. But it's the other scientist who's working that doesn't like their hypothesis, who comes up with evidence that actually rejects it. The problem, the thing about there is that it's rejectable. There
that's
is a
right.
way to do it, and that's what the scientists are doing in religion or astrology or other areas of pseudoscience. And again, let me reiterate, it's fine to believe these things. It's just not fine to label them as science because there's no conceivable thing that can demonstrate them to be false. And if that's the case, then there's no progress in knowledge to be made. Believe them if you like. Don't believe them if you don't. But don't call them science. Astrology, though, is a particular case, if I can return just for a minute, because unlike intelligence design, astrology makes very specific predictions.
Right.
These things will happen, and scientists can study them in unbiased ways and find that, in fact, they don't happen. They clearly don't happen. And so an astrologist who continues to believe in them despite that evidence is not acting scientifically. Again, that doesn't mean that they're psychotic. It's just meaning that they're choosing to go with their primitive belief system. They're saying, even though you've demonstrated for me that the Monty Hall problem is the way it is, I'm going to choose to believe what feels right because I want to. And, of course, that's their choice.
getting to the very end of your book, and it's a very important chapter that you sum up everything that you've written in the book. Science is a terribly flawed enterprise, warts and all, but it is fundamentally different from other approaches to the world. And just sort of flesh that out.
Well, this gets back, you know, science. I think if you look at progress that's been made by different approaches to understanding nature, science has made astounding progress, century after century after century. You can argue whether that progress is good or bad, or whether humans have put it to good or bad use. But it's pretty hard to argue with it. Other approaches to understanding, at least for natural phenomenon, haven't made that kind of progress. But science fails all the time. It just succeeds frequently enough that it keeps making progress. And this is the problem when people say, oh, science is certain, science proves things, et cetera. Not the case, because when people say, well, yes, there's all this evidence that the Earth is getting warmer, but you haven't proved it to an absolute certainty, that's an impossible goal. If that's your standard, then we will never know. We will never know anything. And on the other side, science sometimes makes horrible mistakes. And when people say, well, science got this wrong, why should we trust science in the future? Well, you shouldn't trust science to be absolutely true, but you should trust science to make greater progress and be our greatest tool. If anything is going to work, a science will. But the expectation of perfection, I mean, you can't apply that to anything. And to apply it to science just kind of destroys the whole credibility of the system.
From your own writing, nope, there is no promise that science will head us toward an abstract truth. And you prove that throughout the book. But it will increase our ability to predict and control the natural world, and that's always what it's done.
I mean, this is an important distinction to make, because, you know, you think about all of the theories over the past three centuries that turned out to be wrong, theory after theory that turned out to be wrong. But the technology that the theories gave rise to still works.
That's right.
Right? So our vaccines still work. Our antibiotics still work. Our planes typically fly unless something goes terribly wrong. So abstract knowledge, absolute understanding of why things work, that may elude us in perfect form forever. But that things are working, that we're making technological progress, that our ability to improve the human condition continues to develop, whether we use it to improve the human condition or not, that seems very hard to argue with. But that distinction between fundamentally getting to the truth and doing useful stuff is an American distinction. It's called pragmatism. And I think, from my point of view at least, that's the right approach.
My guest tonight has been James C. Zimring, professor of pathology at the University of Virginia, considered an international expert in the field of transfusion biology, and talking about his important new book, What Science Really Is and How It Really Works. Jim, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.